Today's broadcast originally aired on November 27th, 2023.
The right to vote is the crown jewel of American liberties, and we will not see its luster diminished.
So said Ronald Reagan when he signed a 25-year extension of the Voting Rights Act, only to see his colleagues rip it apart ever since.
I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. We are, let's say, happy-ish to be back from after some much-needed family time.
True.
And a Thanksgiving break. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hello.
Hope you had a restful, peaceful one.
Yes, and of course, Mondays after a holiday weekend are always harder.
Oh, no, not at all. They're always fantastic. But we are happy to return with what actually suffices these days for some good news out of the Middle East, as Israel and Hamas on Monday agreed to extend the current 4-day pause in fighting for hostage and prisoner swaps for another 2 days. I'll try to get to more details on that a little bit later in today's program. Of course, a whole lot of stuff happened elsewhere in the world and here at home as we were otherwise trying to stand down, especially as TPM's David Kurtz reminds today, by the time we sit down for Turkey again next year, Donald Trump may be the president-elect for a second time. If this was the last Thanksgiving before the end of democracy as we know it, he writes, I hope you had a good one. And I share his sentiments. Now, the end of democracy as we know it, I realize it sounds like a pretty grandiose statement, but guess what? I gotta say, I do not think that is overblown, particularly as he follows up with his thoughts on what will matter most in 2024. Writes Kurtz, the rule of law is on the ballot in 2024, and it trumps every other political and policy consideration. It is the umbrella under which every other issue is addressed. Want to restore abortion rights? Want to openly debate Israel and Palestine? Want to accelerate the energy revolution to head off the worst of climate change? Good luck. Because if Trump, as promised, harnesses the power of the federal government to attack his perceived political enemies, extract retribution for slights, overturn elections, eviscerate the right to vote, and continue the effort to lock in GOP minority rule, he will break the democratic mechanisms for adjudicating policy preferences, enacting new laws, and enforcing them. Trump is promising a fundamental break with the rule of law, and from that will flow a fundamental breakdown in democratic processes and institutions. It is as simple as it is hard to stay at maximum threat level for years on end. If elections don't count, he writes, if Trump and the GOP won't accept defeat as an option, if a majority of the electorate can't make its voice heard at the ballot box, then nothing else really matters. It is as stark a choice as the United States has ever faced. And I gotta say, I absolutely concur with that as well from David Kurtz. This choice next year, at least based on who appear to be the front runners for the two major parties next year, is absolutely that stark, that choice. That's not an endorsement. That is just a fact, and one that I hope to dive into a little bit more in detail on the days ahead this week. For today, however, even before we get to what may or may not happen under a potential second Trump term, we've got plenty to worry about regarding next year's elections just based on the judges and Supreme Court justices that Donald Trump has already put in place and the undermining of the rule of law that has come with it. As far as I can tell, at least when it comes to what happened in this country over the past week or so, nothing comes close to what happened in a federal appeals court in my old hometown of St. Louis, Missouri last week, where a three-judge panel on the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals agreed with a lower U.S. District Court judge that Section 2 of the landmark Voting Rights Act of 1965 does not allow private parties, such as individual voters or public interest civil rights groups like the NAACP or the ACLU, to sue jurisdictions in order to enforce the Voting Rights Act's prohibition on racially discriminatory election laws. The appellate court panel's split decision, they split 2-1, where all three judges on the panel had been appointed by Republicans with two Trump appointees and one George W. Bush appointee. That split panel held that there is no private right of action to sue specified in the Voting Rights Act under Section 2, and therefore nobody other than the U.S. Attorney General may actually sue to block any racially discriminatory election law. Previously, individual voters and organizations could sue under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which prevented such laws from going into effect in advance of an election if the jurisdiction could not show that they were not discriminatory laws. But previous Supreme Court rulings have for now gutted Section 5. When the court did that in 2013 in Shelby County versus Holder, Chief Justice John Roberts made clear that while Section 5 was inoperative for the moment, plaintiffs could still sue to block racially discriminatory laws under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. So really no big loss is how he sort of painted it. But given the Eighth Circuit, Circuit's ruling last week, and yes, it really is mind-blowing, the only entity, if I am understanding this ruling correctly, which can sue under Section 2 to block racially discriminatory voting laws under the Voting Rights Act is the Attorney General of the United States, whoever that may happen to be at any given time. That despite the fact that over the nearly 60 years since the passage of the landmark Voting Rights Act and numerous reauthorizations of it by Congress and, yes, Republican presidents like Ronald Reagan, who you heard at the top of the show, reauthorizing the act for 25 years, and George W. Bush, despite that, the majority of all of the lawsuits that have been filed, fought, and won to prevent discrimination in our voting laws under the VRA have been filed not by the federal government or the U.S. Attorney General, but by individual voters and good government, anti-discrimination, civil rights organizations. The Eighth Circuit Court's ruling last week, a 2-1 decision led by a Trump-appointed judge and a George W. Bush-appointed judge, was and is so bad and so disturbing, at least as I see it, that I think it has frankly, not received the press that it deserves because, well, there's so much going on elsewhere right now. But also, in large part, I think that some, including myself, even when I first heard this, had the sort of the immediate tendency to sort of dismiss or downplay this ruling because, in one sense, it just seems so unreal that it seems like it couldn't even be possible. It also came just before Thanksgiving, the holiday when people were traveling, preparing for their Thanksgiving, otherwise not paying attention to what seems to me to be an extraordinarily disturbing development out of a federal appeals courtroom. But the ruling, as I read it, really is that bad and is that disturbing that we really need to talk about it today. Joining us for exactly that is Jonathan Topaz, staff attorney at the ACLU Voting Rights Project. Jonathan has litigated voting rights cases in federal and state courts nationwide, including at the U.S. Supreme Court, in cases related to redistricting, felon disenfranchisement, the census, and other discriminatory barriers to the vote. He also worked on the case in question, the one that was had a stunning ruling from the Eighth Circuit last week. He worked on that case at both the district and appellate court level, which is a racial gerrymandering case out of Arkansas, where the state chapter of the NAACP and others allege that the state's legislative districts violated the Voting Rights Act by diluting the power of black voters. A lower court judge, also a Trump appointee, ruled in early 2022 that he couldn't decide the case on its merits because he found that there was no private right of action for the plaintiffs here, the NAACP and their legal representation by the ACLU. That effectively meant that those folks had no right to bring the lawsuit at all, never mind the merits of the case. That ruling, which last week the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld. Jonathan Topaz, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Thank you for having me.
So, very quickly, what was this case meant to challenge in Arkansas before the court decided that you and the NAACP had no legal authority under the Voting Rights Act to even challenge it?
This case was a challenge to the redistricting plan for the Arkansas State House. The Arkansas State House map had 11 majority black districts in Arkansas. That was a decline from the previous map, despite the increase in the black population in Arkansas. And in fact, the black population in Arkansas is close to 16%. Of the voters there. So it was a significant underrepresentation for Black Arkansans. And we brought challenge on behalf of our plaintiffs, Arkansas State Conference of the NAACP and the Arkansas Public Policy Panel, on grounds that it diluted the votes of Black Arkansans and that the state could have actually drawn a map that had five additional majority Black seats in the state house. And this was a case that the district court found was a strong merits case. Usually when you bring these Section 2 vote dilution cases, you might be challenging perhaps net one or two districts. Let's say five is very significant dilution.
So the lower court found that there was merit to this case, but said, sorry, I can't do anything about it because you can't sue under the Voting Rights Act?
That's right. The court was the first court in the history of the United States to determine that Section 2 lacked a private right of action, which means that private plaintiffs are unable to vindicate their rights under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. This, at the time and today, is an incredibly radical ruling, and we appealed because it has no basis in the text and structure of the Voting Rights Act. It had no basis in the precedent, and it certainly had no basis in the practice of decades and decades of private plaintiffs bringing suits to vindicate the incredibly important right to vote free of racial discrimination under the Voting Rights Act. And as you alluded to, unfortunately, last week, a divided panel of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, a federal appeals court, voted 2-1 to affirm the district court's finding that Section 2 lacked a private right of action. So now these are the only two courts in the history of the United States that have ever made such a finding. And this finding from the Eighth Circuit comes about a week after a separate federal appeals court, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, a rather conservative court of appeals, dispatched with this argument very quickly and found that Section 2, in fact, does contain a private right of action. So a very radical opinion on appeal to the detriment of voters in Arkansas and voters around the country.
And the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is like, is I think, known to be the most right wing of all of the appeals courts pretty much in the country, as I understand it. The fact that they were able to find this private right of action and yet they couldn't in the Eighth Circuit is kind of mind blowing. Jonathan, I know that we discussed this with you when the case was, I think, ruled on earlier this year, back in January, as I recall. The original case, but it is so mind-blowing that I got to kind of ask again, how can it be that there have been hundreds of cases under Section 2 brought by individual voters, various good government, voting rights groups, organizations, and so forth, but nobody ever noticed until now, other than these two courts and this out of this Arkansas case? Nobody ever noticed until now that the Voting Rights Act somehow does not allow a private right to sue under Section 2? It just seems infeasible, to put it nicely.
It is infeasible. We certainly think it's impossible. To throw some data at your point, there have been more than 400 Section 2 cases, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act cases litigated in the federal courts in the last 4 decades or so. There have been at least 182 successful cases. And the vast majority of those cases and successful cases were brought by private plaintiffs. Private plaintiffs have been bringing Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act cases across federal courts around the country since 1965, since the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act in 1982 and 2006, unbroken. And to wit, there have been at least 18 such cases decided on the merits at the Eighth Circuit, 11 such cases decided at the Supreme Court on the merits, including recent cases in Alabama, for example, affirming a finding of a Section 2 violation. So to believe these decisions, you would have to believe that all of those courts, including the Eighth Circuit and the Supreme Court, have essentially gotten it wrong and failed to notice a glaring defect that those private plaintiffs had no business being in federal court. That can't possibly be correct. And it can't possibly be correct also that Congress failed to notice that these cases were being filed around the country and failed to amend the statute to clarify in any way. They have seen fit to allow the statute to remain as it is, which is to allow private plaintiffs to vindicate their rights.
I imagine you must have been stunned. I mean, it's one thing when it's one judge, one U.S. District Court judge, a Trump appointee comes out with this decision, but for the Court of Appeals to uphold it, it seems stunning. And yet, it would seem equally stunning in some regard if the U.S. Supreme Court upholds it as well. If it is upheld as it was currently found by the Eighth Circuit, if it's upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, what does that then mean for Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act overall and for the ability for anyone other than the U.S. Attorney General to sue a jurisdiction for violating the landmark Voting Rights Act?
It would be a travesty for democracy. As I mentioned, the vast majority of Section 2 cases brought in federal court and the vast majority of successful Section 2 cases throughout the history of the Voting Rights Act have been brought by private plaintiffs. And in fact, the Justice Department has submitted a brief in our case, telling the federal courts that they don't have the resources to enforce Section 2 on their own. They simply cannot bring the number of cases to root out violations across the country to vindicate this right. You know, there is no more Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act in light of Shelby County, or at least there's no meaningful enforcement of Section 5 at this moment. Section 2 is critically important as it has ever been, and even more so. And If private plaintiffs cannot bring suit to enforce Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, then there will be large swaths of violations of that statute that simply will go unchallenged to the detriment of Black voters across this country.
And I want to put forward a hypothetical along those lines in a minute. But before, while we're talking about the Supreme Court, do we have any sense of where the current votes likely are at the Supreme Court on this? Are there now five justices on that court who would be willing to sign on to this unique finding from the Eighth Circuit Court and effectively kill the Voting Rights Act pretty much entirely at this point? Are there five votes now on the high court?
I think I've learned to not try to count votes in general for any court, especially the Supreme Court. And so I couldn't say definitively one way or another.
Uh-huh.
There have been a couple of justices who have suggested in one concurrence recently that they believe this is an open question. But at the same time, in the Milligan case, which was an Alabama redistricting case that we brought along with our other partners, the Supreme Court recently affirmed a Section 2 violation, as I mentioned, and ruled on the merits of that case, finding that Alabama had, in fact, diluted the votes of the political power of Black Alabamians, and certainly did not see the private right issue as a barrier to finding so. So I think the short answer is we don't know.
Did that issue come up at all since the court just decided a Section 2 case brought by private individuals and groups? Did the question about the right to sue under Section 2 come up at all in that case, in the Alabama case?
Not at the Supreme Court. I believe the question was raised at the lower court, and it was not raised at the Supreme Court. So there is a question of whether or not it was directly raised at the Supreme Court and that the justices had the ability to weigh in on it. I would just add, Brad, you know, for your listeners who are not lawyers, they cannot possibly fathom why, from a common sense perspective, that these sort of incredibly technical distinctions would really matter. The idea that the Supreme Court would simply rule on Section 2 cases and find Section 2 violations when they know, in fact, that these cases should not be brought to them by private plaintiffs, I think strains credulity and is the thing that, you know, non-lawyers cannot possibly understand.
But yeah, I don't even think lawyers can understand it. Looking at this, saying this can't be. I was on someone else's show last week, sort of talking about this as this news broke. And I came up, Jonathan, with the most absurd example I could sort of, pull out of thin air, but wasn't able to find a flaw to undermine my own argument. And hopefully you can. So let's say, just to underscore, I know that sounds like a lot of legalese and private right of action. What does it all mean? So I tried to put it into sort of layman's terms here. Let's say a jurisdiction just decided blatantly the most ridiculous, clearly racially defective law possible. They say only white landowners may vote in a presidential election. Obviously, it's a ridiculous notion, as we've come to know voting laws in any event since the passage of the Voting Rights Act. But some jurisdiction does that, some county in the South or a state or whatever. If that happened, while, let's say, a Donald Trump had become president again, and his attorney general did not feel like challenging that law under the Voting Rights Act, that law that said only white landowners may vote in presidential elections, would that law then have to stand because nobody would have the legal standing to challenge it other than Donald Trump's attorney general? Am I understanding this, the implications of this correctly?
Well, I think there would be other grounds to challenge such a law. For example, on constitutional grounds, it would be about as straightforward a constitutional case as you could fathom, and that sort of case could be brought by private plaintiffs. Under this ruling, it would be incredibly difficult for private plaintiffs, if this ruling were to stand, I should say, it would be incredibly difficult for private plaintiffs to challenge such a law under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. The one asterisk here, or footnote, or whatever you call it, is that there is a cause of action, and I apologize for getting into some legalese with your listeners.
That's
here,
okay.
There is a separate cause of action called Section 1983, which allows for private plaintiffs to bring suits to vindicate certain federal and constitutional rights.
Uh-huh.
And there is this question of whether private plaintiffs can bring suit under 1983 to vindicate their rights under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act is something that is currently being litigated now, and something that we argue can be used to vindicate your rights under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, even if Section 2, for whatever reason, does not contain a private right of action. That remains something of a question that is being sorted out in the courts. Several federal courts have found that you can use 1983 to vindicate your rights under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. But your intuition, Brad, generally speaking, is correct, which is that the ability to use the Voting Rights Act to challenge such a blatantly discriminatory law is certainly called into question and imperiled by this ruling, and if this ruling is allowed to stand.
When the U.S. Supreme Court gutted actually Section 4, which is what ended up killing Section 5, we all had to go learn about Section 2. Now that it looks like they could kill Section 2, I guess we all got to learn about Section 1983. Holy cow. Jonathan, what about all of the other rulings? If this moves forward, what about all of the other rulings that have already been made under a private right of action under Section 2? Rulings that, you know, say the ACLU has won to block certain discriminatory laws. Are all of those rulings then tossed out by the Eighth Circuit's ruling if it's upheld by SCOTUS?
That's a good question, Brad. Probably not. It would probably not have the sort of retroactive application, but you're right to be concerned at the sort of shockwaves that this decision would have were it to be upheld at the Supreme Court. At the very least, right now, this is the first federal appeals court to ever find that private plaintiffs can't bring suit under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. There are at least three other federal appeals courts that have found the opposite.
Right.
So right now, there is a disagreement. Well, the Eighth Circuit has ensured that there is a disagreement currently between the federal appeals courts, meaning that Section 2 would be enforced in different ways depending on which jurisdiction you live in. And you're right that this would be a dramatic upheaval in the law that Congress absolutely did not intend. And that's why the decision is one of the reasons that the decision is highly misguided.
And, you know, again, as absurd as it seems, and maybe that's why it's not getting the attention it deserves, but knowing this court, knowing what even Brett Kavanaugh said in the Alabama case, where, you know, we didn't think he was going to approve that one. He did, but he sort of gave some indications that maybe if you bring me a different case, I might have a different opinion on this. I think there's reason to be very concerned. In a statement, Arkansas's Republican Attorney General Tim Griffin, and if that name sounds familiar to you, he used to be a protege of Karl Rove's. He was named as a U.S. attorney during the U.S. attorney scandal under George W. Bush. He is a notorious vote cager himself. We covered him in great detail back in 2007 at bradblog.com. He had submitted a list of mostly black voters with the subject line re-caging, vote caging, which is a way to suppress the vote. He had given this list to Bush, Cheney, and RNC operatives back then, and to try to remove those voters from the voting rolls in the 2004 election in Florida, I believe. He is now the attorney general. That guy who was so shamed by being caught having sent this email trying to cage black voters. He left politics in a teary goodbye speech. Well, guess what? He's back. He's now the attorney general in Arkansas, and he celebrated the ruling at the Eighth Circuit last week. He told Politico, quote, "For far too long, courts across the country have allowed political activists to file meritless lawsuits seeking to seize control of how states conduct elections and redistricting," he said. "This decision confirms that that enforcement of the Voting Rights Act should be handled by politically accountable officials and not by outside special interest groups. I guess you're one of those special interest groups at the ACLU Voting Rights Project, Jonathan. One of those active political activists, I guess. Your response to Tim Griffin sort of spiking the discrimination ball there?
Well, look, I'm not sure it needs much of a response, but one thing that I think is important to say is that our client is the Arkansas State Conference of the NAACP, perhaps the most important group in the entire state of Arkansas, a storied group that is not a political interest group. This is a vitally important, historic civil rights group that has been fighting for the civil rights of all folks in Arkansas, especially and including Black Arkansans, for a very long time. And so that is a disrespectful way to refer to our clients, who are doing what they can to vindicate the civil rights for Black Arkansans, who, to go back to what we talked about at the beginning of this segment, are fighting against unlawful vote dilution in the state house. And so we at the ACLU don't worry too much about what the state of Arkansas has to say in the wake of this decision, but we are considering all of our options to, or exploring all of our options to ensure that we can do what we can to fight against this radical and terrible decision.
And what are those options that you're looking at? And by the way, what other cases, if any, are immediately affected by the Eighth Circuit's ruling until and if it changes somehow?
Well, the decision would have ramifications for cases that are currently in the pipeline in the Eighth Circuit. And the decision will have sort of persuasive authority for other cases, though it won't be binding. But it would make it obviously makes it much more difficult for private plaintiffs in the Eighth Circuit to, at this time at least, vindicate their rights under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Though, as I mentioned, there are still cases that in which plaintiffs are seeking their right to vindicate their rights under Section 1983, which, as you alluded to, unfortunately, Brad, you may need to add to your growing lexicon.
I guess I'm going to have to. And I think the Eighth Circuit is what, Arkansas, Missouri, Nebraska, South Dakota. Am I about right there? There's a couple of others.
That's about there. Right. Okay. I don't know if I have it off the top of my head, but no, that sounds about right.
All right. Well, bone up, Topaz. Come on. I had four of the states. In any event, I think this ruling will be enough just as far as the timing goes. It seems like it's going to be enough to at least prevent Arkansas from having to draw additional new legislative minority voting districts before the 2024 election, even if it gets overturned. Am I right? Are we now pushing the deadline for that to be able to happen by 2024, as it should happen, as it likely would have happened, but for this ruling?
We certainly, don't want to say, never say never, but this is now the second election cycle that is imperiled by discriminatory maps. In 2022, this decision initially came because we were seeking relief ahead of the 2022 election to ensure that there was not a state house map that diluted the political power of Black Arkansans, and the district court's decision prevented relief for that election. And now we will see about the 2024 election, but regardless of the avenue that we end up going down, it will obviously be much harder to get relief now that we need to continue to fight against this decision from the Eighth Circuit. So as usual, Black voters are the ones who have to endure the consequences of these sorts of radical decisions, and specifically in this case, the Black voters in Arkansas.
Absolutely maddening. I'm glad that the ACLU is still there to fight this, the ACLU Voting Rights Project, but it is getting harder and harder. Yeah, I mean, I imagine under Section 5, you would have been able to stop this in advance. Now it's election after election, and, even if it's found to be unlawful, unconstitutional, how many elections have passed under these unconstitutional laws? It's really... Appalling and enraging, frankly. Jonathan Topaz, you can find him. I think he's on Twitter at Jonathan Topaz, but his tweets may be protected. You can find ACLU on Twitter as well, and of course at ACLU.org. Jonathan Topaz is a staff attorney in the ACLU Voting Rights Project. Jonathan, always great speaking with you, and sadly, I suspect we'll have cause to do so again in the not-too-distant future.
Well, thank you for having me, and appreciate in particular your continued interest and attention to this very important issue.
Because someone's gotta. Thank you, brother. Really appreciate it. All right.
Take care.
You at bet. Take care. All right. We'll take a quick break here. Now, actually, over the weekend, I was told that our phones here at KPFK were down. And that here at the station. And so I planned a show without calls, and I got plenty to talk about. That said, the good news is that, Wendell, it looks like our phones are supposedly back in order, he says. Yes, all right. Supposedly they're fixed. So if you'd like to ring in today on anything regarding voting, next year's elections, the Supreme Court, anything else that you've heard about over the past week, or what I am hoping to discuss after a quick break here, regarding Israel and Hamas. Our number, if it's working, is 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. But let's get to a short break here. We'll come back with actually some positive news, if you can believe it, out of the Israel and Hamas war, or at least what will have to suffice for positive news today, and some grim news from here in the U.S., seemingly in response to it. That, maybe your calls, and maybe much more, is still ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Here at the Bradcast and bradblog.com, we fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to do it. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate to make an automated monthly pledge of any amount you like, or even just a one-time only contribution to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. The fight for voting rights, civil rights, and to save our planet continues. Please help us continue that fight independently over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate right now. Go ahead, do it right now. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you.
You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
Back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. I mentioned, by the way, with Jonathan Topaz, who I thank again for joining us today. I mentioned a show that I was on last week. That show was the show of the great Nicole Sandler. Both Desi and I sat in for a great hour of video podcasting with Nicole, and I've posted it to bradblog.com if you want to check it out. I think it was very funny.
It was a lot of fun.
If you want to see what Desi and I look like these days,
yeah,
you can take both of us, great face. Well, me, great face for radio.
Speak for yourself, yeah.
But sorry about that. But anyway, check it out. You can scroll down. It's near the top of bradblog.com, and I think it was really funny. Plus, there was some news value. There was some news breaking that I covered on her show as well. Plus, we use curse words because it's not FCC radio, so we can...
Ooh.
If you want to hear what we really sound like every day. Israel and Hamas have agreed to extend their ceasefire for two more days past Monday, the Qatari government has said on Monday, raising the prospect of a longer halt to their deadliest and most destructive war and further exchanges of militant-held hostages for Palestinians imprisoned by Israel. The announcement came on the final day of the original 4-day truce between the warring sides, brokered largely by Qatar, Egypt, and the Biden administration, with the president said to be taking a very hands-on personal role in those negotiations. Israel has said it would extend the ceasefire by one day for every 10 additional hostages that were released by Hamas. U.S. National Security Council spokesman Jack Kirby hailed the encouraging news on Monday.
Of course, we welcome the announcement that the humanitarian pause in Gaza, now in its fourth day, will be extended for another 2 days through Thursday morning Israel time. This humanitarian pause has already brought a halt to the fighting, together with a surge of humanitarian assistance. Now, in order to extend the pause, Hamas has committed to releasing another 20 women and children over the next 2 days. We would, of course, hope to see the pause extended further, and that will depend upon Hamas continuing to release hostages.
Now, Israel says it's nonetheless also remaining committed to crushing Hamas's military capabilities, ending its 16-year rule over Gaza after its October 7 attack into southern Israel that killed some 1,200, including women and children. That commitment would mean a likely expansion of a ground offensive from devastated northern Gaza into the south, where hundreds of thousands of Palestinians have crammed into UN shelters and where dire conditions persist despite the increased delivery of aid during the brief truce, as some 14,000 Palestinians have been killed by Israel to date, including thousands of women and children, according to the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry. So far, 69 hostages have been released during the current truce, including 11 over the past hour or two that were released, including 2 3-year-old twins that were being held by Hamas. In exchange, Israel has released at least 117 Palestinians, also, by the way, including women and children, from prison since the truce began. The latest hostage releases still leave about 170 in captivity in Gaza after they were abducted from Israel on October 7, and thousands of Palestinians still being held in Israeli prisons. There are enough hostages to potentially extend the ceasefire for 2.5 weeks, but those include a number of soldiers and Hamas's thought likely to make much greater demands for their release. We can get all hostages back home. We have to keep pushing. That, according to two relatives of Abigail Eden, a 4-year-old girl who was released on Sunday after her parents were killed on October 7. That 4-year-old is a dual Israeli-American citizen. The calm from the truce allowed glimpses of the destruction wreaked by weeks of Israeli bombardment that leveled entire neighborhoods. The Israeli assault has driven 3/4 of Gaza's population from their homes, and now most of its 2.3 million people are crowded into the south of this tiny strip of land, and more than 1 million are living in UN shelters. Rain and wind added to the hardship of the displaced Palestinians in recent days. One disabled resident said his clothes are all wet. He's unable to change them. He said, "I have not drunk water for 2 days, and there is no bathroom to use." The conditions are said to be horrible overall, even as the truce has made it possible to scale up the delivery of food, water, medicine to the largest volume since the start of the war. But the 160 to 200 trucks a day coming in is still less than half of what Gaza was importing before the war, even as humanitarian needs have since soared. A vendor in the urban Nusrat refugee camp in central Gaza said many families were still unable to retrieve the dead from under the rubble that was left by Israeli airstrikes, and that local authorities were not equipped to deal with that level of destruction. Meanwhile, back in the U.S. over the weekend, a 48-year-old Vermont man was charged on Monday with 3 counts of attempted second-degree murder in the weekend shootings of 3 young men of Palestinian descent on a normally peaceful Burlington, Vermont street. A violent episode that stunned the small city The man has pleaded not guilty. The suspect, Jason J. Eaton, was held without bail pending a bail hearing. The three men, all age 20, were spending their Thanksgiving break in Burlington, according to an affidavit of probable cause filed by the Burlington police. The alleged shooter apparently encountered the three young men, all of them students, just before 6:30 p.m. on Saturday outside the apartment building where the alleged shooter lives near the University of Vermont campus. The affidavit said the gunman walked up, pulled out a handgun, and started shooting at them from about 2 yards away. According to the court documents, Hisham Awartani, a student at Brown University, was shot in the spine. Tahsin Ahmed, a student at Trinity College, was struck in the chest. And Kinan Abdelhamid, a student at Haverford College, was struck in the backside. They were walking to the house of Mr. Awartani's grandmother for dinner on Saturday night. The young men told family members they were speaking a hybrid of English and Arabic before the man shot at them 4 times without saying anything, according to a family spokesperson. Two of the victims were wearing traditional Palestinian kafaya scarves. The police searched the alleged shooter's apartment. They found a pistol and a loaded magazine containing 5 rounds of ammunition of the same brand as some that were found at the scene of the shooting. The affidavit also noted that when an agent from the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives made contact with the man on Sunday, the suspect, quote, made a statement to the effect of, "I've been waiting for you." The suspect's mother, Mary Reed, told the Daily Beast that her son suffered from depression, but seemed to be in a good mood when she saw him on Thanksgiving. She described him as, quote, kind and loving, as well as, quote, a very religious person. Though none of the coverage that I have seen to date even suggests what religion that might be of the shooter. Attorney General Merrick Garland said in Manhattan on Monday that the FBI and the ATF were investigating the shooting of the three students, including the question of whether or not it was a hate crime.
As always, but especially now, the Justice Department is remaining vigilant in the face of the potential threats of hate-fueled violence and terrorism. We are closely monitoring the impact that the conflict in the Middle East may have in inspiring foreign terrorist organizations, homegrown violent extremists, and domestic violent extremists, both here in the United States and abroad. All of us have also seen a sharp increase in the volume and frequency of threats against Jewish, Muslim, and Arab communities across our country since October 7th. There is understandable fear in communities across the country. Even as we speak, the ATF and the FBI are investigating the tragic shooting of 3 men of Palestinian descent in Vermont. That investigation, including whether this is a hate crime, is ongoing. The Justice Department is poised to provide assistance, any assistance that our state and local law enforcement partners need as we work together to protect our communities.
Burlington Police Chief John Murad said, quote, "The fact is that we don't know as much as we want to know right now." He said, quote, that he urges the public to avoid making conclusions based on statements from uninvolved parties who know even less, said the chief. Our phone number is 818-985-5735. We may be able to get in a few calls. 818-985-KPFK on this or on Supreme Court, voting rights, or anything else you'd like to try to fit in. The Ramallah Friends School posted a statement on Facebook saying the 3 young men were graduates of the private school in the West Bank. Senator Bernie Sanders, the Vermont independent senator, denounced the shooting, noting in a statement, quote, "It is shocking and deeply upsetting that 3 young Palestinians were shot here in Burlington, Vermont. Hate has no place here or anywhere. I look forward to a full investigation." The Vermont, New Hampshire chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace, which has urged an end to the Israel-Hamas war, released a statement saying it was, quote, "appalled by the shooting." The American Jewish Committee an advocacy organization for Jewish people worldwide, also said it was, quote, horrified by the attack and urged, quote, law enforcement to investigate this act as a possible hate crime. Last month, you may recall, and Illinois landlord was charged with a hate crime himself after being accused of fatally stabbing a six-year-old Muslim boy and seriously wounding his mother in suburban Chicago. Police and relatives said he singled out the victims because of their faith. At the same time, of course, Jewish communities and organizations have been targeted since the October 7 attack in Israel as well. 818-985-5735. Let me go to, we lost Matt. All right, we'll go to Roger. Oh, Roger, our friend from Minneapolis. Hey, Roger, welcome back to the broadcast, sir. Oh, Roger, having trouble hearing you.
Missouri.
There we go.
Even though it's none of my beeswax.
Now, you see, Roger called in when we were on Nicole Sandler's show last week, and he asked where we were going for the holidays, and I told him it was none of his beeswax, because it's not, Roger.
Well, Nicole spilled the beans today. She revealed that you visited your mom in the Phoenix greater area, and then you went back to L.A., so the jig is up. Anyway, the reason that I called...
Yeah. Are you trying to dox me on air? All right, go ahead, Roger. Yeah. Why did you call? Yes.
No. I'm reporting. I'm paddling on Nicole.
Okay.
She
doxed me. Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Fair enough. All right.
Moving right along.
Yes.
Today I listened on WCSP, the C-SPAN radio, noon Eastern time. A discussion at the National Constitution Center, three scholars discussing the possible rise of authoritarianism in this country. And their
possible
discussion was interesting.
Yeah.
They all three seemed to feel that the Constitution would somehow fend off the rise of authoritarianism in this country.
Mm.
But none of them took into account this Eighth Circuit Court ruling. This is a catastrophe.
Yep.
And it is really busting the floodgates of our possibility of fending off fascism.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, Roger, until the news broke of the extended ceasefire, pause, truce, whatever we want to call it in Israel, I had hoped to talk about exactly that and how that was a sign from the Eighth Circuit of what is potentially to come. It's getting really bad out there. Hopefully I'll be able to pick some of that up on tomorrow's broadcast, because if people are not paying attention, if they think, oh, it's just, you know, Donald Trump, we survived it before, it'll be fine. After all, Joe Biden is old. If they think that is some sort, or they don't like Joe Biden's position on Israel or anything else, if they think that is a reason to stay home or to vote for Donald Trump, of course, I would like to talk to them on this program, because I don't think they really understand what is going on, what we are facing, what is ahead of us this time next year, happens. Yes.
Brad, let me kindly, Professor Roger from Minneapolis,
yes,
give you and our audience and Desi a little bit of homework tonight.
Okay, quickly.
Go to the C-SPAN radio website and listen to the replay of the discussion, because they're running it again this evening, and there may even be a archived version of it. I think it's essential.
Oh, no. Did we just lose Roger? We just lost Roger. Okay, Roger, I think you were going to say it's essential viewing. If so, please feel free to send me a link. My email address is bradcast@bradblog.com, and I will try to look at it. And by the way, others may do that as well, bradcast@bradblog.com, or you may tweet me. I am TheBradBlog, or if you dial quick, you might be able to get in before the clock is up. 818-985-5735. Pouffet, our friend, writes via email to bradcast@bradblog.com, is it possible that Trader Trump had a hand in the conflict. I think he's talking about the Israel conflict here. He may have passed on classified info to Putin. I think that's Putin, who in turn passed it on to Iran, who in turn passed it on to Hamas, giving Hamas the opportunity to know when to attack. Now Israel is weakened and Iran has become the regional power. After all that Trump did to weaken Iran only made Iran stronger. Iran did say they would extract revenge when traitor Trump assassinated the popular general there. Thank you. Love always, says Pouffet. Always good to hear from him. I don't know. And really, there's a lot of questions about how that October 7th attack came about at all. The notion was that or the claims were that Netanyahu had been focusing the Israeli military up north on the West Bank to protect the extremist settlers there. And had sort of taken his eye off the ball down in Gaza. And it came at a very great price. But I guess if there can be any upside to this, apparently the people of Israel have finally figured out what a cretin Bibi Netanyahu is. He's wildly unpopular. And it's pretty clear that once this war is over, he will be out. He just does not have the support of the Israeli people. That problem is, however, the paradox is that means that the longer the war goes, the longer Netanyahu can stay in power. He doesn't really have an interest in ending this thing, it seems to me, because he has been willing to do anything to stay in power.
Well, yes. Isn't that sort of what happens with, say, a wartime president, is that you continue the war because you won't get voted out as long as the war continues?
Yeah, but normally there's a rally around the flag effect. You would expect that there would be more support for Netanyahu instead of less. His support and the support of his party, Likud, has just flatlined. And yet there he is remaining in power and will be for quite some time, apparently. And by the way, in doing so, avoiding accountability for the, I think, three different felony charges that he is facing. And so no wonder he doesn't appear to actually have a plan for what happens when they do, if they do get rid of Hamas. What happens next? Nobody knows. Netanyahu is apparently in no hurry to figure it out either.
Yeah, there's no plan for what happens after.
All right, we got to get out. I'm sorry we lost our phones there again. Hopefully we'll fix them next time. We had some problems, but thanks to those of you who did try to get through. Thanks as well to our guest today, Jonathan Topaz of ACLU's Voting Rights Project, to our board operator, the great Wendell Handy. Thank you, sir. And to the delightful producer, Desi Doyen. Thanks, Des. And thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. You can also drop me an email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site still known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog. We will see you there until we see you here, hopefully tomorrow. I'm Brad Friedman.
Listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.